Should go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
My truth is the truth that you will never understand.
Private ownership is one single individual giving the green light. Doesn't that tell you that your system is more akin to authoritarian dictatorship?
It's no, we have a king. I thought we're an autonomous collective.
What the heck is a D? How come he can buy our house when it's our house and we live there?
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. The rights aren't rights if someone could take them away.
They have every man in a straitjacket. To leave a country is like breaking out of jail. And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
Academy essentially opens up policing to the citizens. It's a pretty anarchic idea for an 80s movie.
Not only go on strike, but we need to fire the bosses. This whole you getting paid more, doing less work thing, it's not working out, Steve.
All right. Welcome to the Three Left Show. I am your host, Dan Platt. The Three Left Show is a leftist political talk show. Welcome to the next 2 hours of pain. No, not really, actually. It's actually going to be quite positive, I feel. Hopefully the last few weeks have been more negative, of course, but this is going to be an ecology episode. Why would I do that? Do the intro. This program covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective for the curious or the committed. This show promotes a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy, a left that is of itself and for itself, the meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. Those are the three lefts, and we wave those flags proudly. So this show will be about ecology and how it intersects with all sorts of things. I'm going to go back to my usual trusted format that I like, which is first few bits, which will be a broad statement of the issues, broad coverage of the issues at hand. Then more deeper analysis of kind of the issues, mostly centering on gentrification this episode, but also the need for degrowth. This is a concept I've covered in previous episodes. Degrowth pretty much means, in a nutshell, that our economy cannot keep growing indefinitely. We need to either plateau in some way, in a sustainable way, but more likely we actually need to cut back. We have a lot of waste in our system, real lot of waste and unfair, inequitable distribution of resources. How do we do that? Well, along with analysis, I will also be pointing out intelligent responses/solutions to these broader problems with individual projects or broader policy and what are the big goals. What's the agenda? We all should have one. If you don't have one, someone else's or something else's agenda is going to act on you. But first, that broad, I could have 100 other comments about variety of news stories and points and things happening week to week, but I like to keep my shows evergreen. That means you can listen to them at any kind of time and time, not dependent on the usual news cycle, news circus. Most Americans don't even pay attention to it anyway. Completely tuned out. Can't blame them. They say it makes them a mix of depressed and or angry, and they really don't know how to act on those feelings. So let's see if we can help with that. Or we can do something a little different. So the first story is kind of a, how does environmentalism broadly fail? How it does not address our ecological problems, sustainability does not bring sustainability. Short answer, it's working within a corrupt, broken/unfair system. And here is a example of that. And by broken, I also mean authoritarian. Why Detroit residents push back against tree planting. We all love trees, right? We're all supposed to love trees, especially me, tree hugger. I have not actually physically hugged a tree, maybe once. I was experimenting. But this is written by a Britton Mock last year, in fact, from CityLab, a publication that covers kind of urban planning, urban design issues, or urban politics sometimes as it comes through here. Detroiters were refusing city-sponsored free trees. A researcher found out the problem. She was the first person to ask them if they wanted them. A landmark report conducted by University of Michigan environmental sociologist Dorsetta Taylor in 2014 warned of the arrogance of white environmentalists when they introduced green initiatives to black and brown communities. One black environmental professional Taylor interviewed for the report, and Elliot Payne, described experiences where green groups, quote, presume to know what's best for communities of color without including them in the decision-making and planning processes. This is just another one of those examples of that latent white supremacy that whites know better. Even if they do not literally think that, they act like it. And if you're acting like it, then you're saying that. Quoting him again, Elliot, Mr. Payne. I think a lot of the times it stems from the approach of, oh, we just go out and offer tree plantings or engaging in an outdoor activity, and if we just reach out to them, they will come, Payne told Taylor. The exact opposite way to actually effectively organize. In fact, this is exactly what was happening in Detroit at the time that Taylor's report came out. In 2014, the city was a few years deep into a campaign to reforest its streets after decades of neglecting to maintain its depleted tree canopy. A local environmental nonprofit called Greening of Detroit was the city's official partner for carrying out that reforesting task. Ooh, public-private partnership. Which it had started doing on its own when it was founded in 89. By 2014, the Greening of Detroit had received additional funding to ramp up its tree planting service to the tune of 1,000 to 5,000 new trees per year. To meet that goal, it had to penetrate neighborhoods somewhat more aggressively than it had in the past to win more buy-in from the residents. The tree planters met stiff resistance. Roughly a quarter, 7,500 residents they approached, declined offers to have new trees planted in front of their homes. It was a high enough volume of rejections for such an otherwise valuable service that a University of Vermont researcher, Kristen E. Carmichael, wanted to know the reason. Otherwise, you fall back on bigoted reasons like these stupid people. They don't even want trees. But let's not be bigoted. She obtained data that the group had collected on the people who turned them down and then visited Detroit to interview staff members and residents. What she found is that the rejections had more to do with how the tree planters presented themselves and residents' distrust of city government. Can't imagine why they distrust their government. Than it did with how residents felt about trees. Carmichael's findings with the co-author, Marlene McDowell, were published this week in the Journal of Society and Natural Resources. Shouldn't trail off that much. I think I'm being dramatic, but really, you can't hear me. The residents Carmichael surveyed understood the benefits of having trees in urban environments. They provide shade and cooling. They absorb air pollution, especially from traffic. They increase property value. I don't care about that. But if you have financing that depends on, you know, high values, then yeah. But that's a banking problem, not a natural problem. And improve health outcomes. You know, having trees is nice. But the reasons Detroit folks were submitting a no-tree request were rooted in how they have historically interpreted their lived experiences in the city, or what Carmichael calls the heritage narrative. These are the stories that people from all walks of Detroit life tell themselves and each other about why city conditions are the way they are. Right? Internal narrative or, you know, narrative to understand the world. Their heritage narrative, and this is a nice term because it also, like, you know, if you're puzzled and confused and angry at people protesting the lockdowns, they have their own narrative. A narrative that speaks to that if it isn't someone like them in charge, then it's an authority that must be opposed. If it is, then the authority is great, which is actually pretty honest if they would actually say that. I certainly would. I'm honest. You know, I'm a little authoritarian if it's somebody like me. I'll be honest about that. So oppose me if you dare. And many do. Anyway. A couple of African-American women Carmichael talked to linked the tree planting program to a painful racist moment in Detroit's history. It was right after 1967 race rebellion. And that is the social scientific term, instead of calling it a race riot or something else, something worse. When the study suddenly became the city, after the quote-unquote race riots of the late 60s, this would have occurred right after, say, Martin Luther King was shot, for example, of why everyone would get so upset and uppity. How did the city respond? Did they respond by desegregating? Did they respond by actually following the calls from the civil rights movement? No. They cut down a majority of the elm trees in bulk in their neighborhoods. The city did this, as the woman understood it, so that law enforcement and intelligence agents could better surveil, meaning watch, their neighborhoods from helicopter and other high places after that urban uprising. The city was chopping down trees at a faster clip at this time, and the city was flying helicopters over their homes at one point to spray toxic DDT from above on those trees. However, the government's stated reason for the mass tree choppings was that the trees were dying off from the Dutch elm disease, then spreading across the country. These were competing narratives of the same event, the clearing away of trees in the late 60s. The two narratives are in conflict, but it was the woman's version, based on their lived experience, that led to their decision to reject the trees today. It's not that they didn't trust the trees. They didn't trust the city, especially since the trees would block them from being watched by drones now. Another benefit, trees provide privacy in this world that not a world, but a system that does not wants to deny us that. But they felt that they should have a choice. In this case, the women felt that after the race rebellion, the city just came in and cut down their trees. And now they want to just come in planting them, said Carmichael. But they felt that they should have a choice in this, since they'll be the ones caring for the trees and raking the leaves when the planters leave. They felt that the decisions regarding whether to cut down trees or plant new ones were being made by someone else. They were going to have to deal with the consequences, by they meaning the residents. There was distrust not only of the city, but of the tree planters as well, particularly considering how most of the nonprofit staff stepped to the people in the communities they were plotting on. The Greening of Detroit had 50,000 volunteers. That is a lot. Most of them white and not from Detroit. The organization had just one community outreach person on staff. That is not a good proportion. 50,000 and they only have one outreach person? Whoa. And that outreach apparently did not include involving neighborhood residents in the planning of the urban forestry program. Big mistake. Big mistake. Now, a lot of cities have learned from stuff like this. This was in 2014, so the lesson has been learned. A lot of cities do include community engagement, public meetings that are open and somewhat actually flyered, so that people walking around notice them. They're usually for like planning, that creating plans that then get shelved, or like they're guiding plans so that developers would hypothetically follow what community residents want in their neighborhood. For example, we need a pharmacy on this corner. So the accepted wisdom is that when someone applies to build there, the design or the zoning or the whatever, the permit would be like, well, it needs to be like a pharmacy there or some kind of retail. City residents could request a tree planting in their neighborhood from the Greening of Detroit, but the nonprofit's green infrastructure staff decide in which neighborhoods to plant trees, as well as tree species to plant and the tree maintenance protocol, the rules. So the people who were getting the trees weren't deciding anything about the trees. I don't know why they thought this was good or proper, but they probably had a mindset of, we're the experts, we know what we're doing, the residents there don't. But again, if decisions affect somebody, they need to take part in those decisions. That is democracy rule number one. So they were acting undemocratically. The green infrastructure staff members committed to maintaining trees for 3 years after planting, which residents were informed of through door hangers and at community meetings, if they attended them. Failing to meaningfully involve the residents in the decision-making is a classic environmental justice no-no. However, from reading excerpts of Carmichael's interviews with the nonprofit staff members, it's clear some of the tree planters thought they were doing these communities an environmental justice solid. After all, who would turn down a free tree on their property, given all of the health and economic benefits? Perhaps these people just don't get it, as one staff member told Carmichael in the study. Here's their words. You're dealing with a generation that has not been used to having trees. The people who remember the elms are getting older and older. Now we've got generations of people who have grown up without trees on their street. They don't even know what they're missing. However, environmental justice is not just about the distribution of bad stuff, like pollution, or good stuff, like forestry projects. It's also about the distribution of power among communities that have historically only been the subjects and experiments of power structures. In 2014, Detroit had an African-American population of 83%, the highest rate of, along with the highest rate of concentrated poverty among the top 25 metros in the U.S. This is according to Brookings. This forestry project was ramping up right as the city was in the throes of bankruptcy. These residents may have had different priorities in mind than those carried by the tree planters who came knocking. Race and class matter in urban greening agendas. As the city of Houston once learned when it failed to survey non-white lower-income residents for their creation of its parks master plan in 2014. They didn't even do any door knocking whatsoever. And I visited Houston. It is a terrible city, though I did not tour all of it. It was impossible to do so without renting a car. Touring a city in my mind is not driving around it. One Detroit resident whom Carmichael interviewed for her study told her, "You know what? I really appreciate you today because that shows that someone is listening and someone is trying to find out what's really going on, the way we feel, and I just appreciate you guys." So this is somebody praising Carmichael because she actually came around to ask them how they felt about trees, not just, "Do you want trees?" And at least they asked, right, instead of just going around planting them willy-nilly. That would be even worse. So it's a step forward, but it's not far enough. A capacity to fill every community partner's needs was, in hindsight, a bit more difficult to achieve, and that resulted in some impressions among some individuals about not feeling the inclusion. Also, the city itself didn't have the capacity to bring down dead trees nor to prune them, plus the fact that we were now replanting trees in some really decimated areas with no other tree canopy. It left people questioning whether they were going to be taken care of. It just didn't jib right with all of our resident partners. Now, a little hypothesis about that proportion of one outreach person for 50,000 volunteers. You may have a lot of suburbanites who are really up to plant trees because planting trees feels good, especially on Arbor Day or To Be Spot. But how many of them wanted to volunteer to door knock to talk to the poor inner city residents? They might have some bias there. They might have some fears, unjustified, bigoted fears that they need to handle or get over or consider, at least introspect about. An introspection I did when I was a teenager. So if you can get the gist of why I read that, it was mostly to expose the issue of power dynamics when it comes to environmentalism, doing environmental activism, even on the nonprofit, let's just plant some trees and it's nice and fluffy kind of side of things. But that can still fail to actually achieve any positive results, especially when it comes to doing climate or environmental justice. That if you're not including and being democratic and actually getting over whatever biases you have, that it's not going to be good work out. So now for a different kind of bias, which is the bias against nature itself. So this permeates kind of everything about our culture, our society, and in a certain type of analysis is also grouped in with white supremacy. White supremacy isn't just about dominating people who aren't light-skinned. It's also about dominating nature, that there is this greater hierarchy, and what justifies it is that these other people are more natural. They're in a natural state. And just like nature, just like the Bible says, we have the ability, the right to dominate it, to manage it, to be the stewards. God wills it. So this story is from Sentient Media. Piece. It's a piece. "Stop treating animals as invaders for simply trying to exist." Subtitle: "Wild animals around the world are being removed from human communities and killed en masse. What are the animals doing to deserve this punishment?" And that is then can be scaled up to entire black and brown communities. Why are they being mass jailed? Why are they being shot? Are they really that threatening to the power structure? Are they threatening other people? Are they really just, or are they just trying to exist? Why aren't they provided for? Why do they have a lack of opportunities, right? To get at, like, oh, well, because they commit crimes. Well, why do they commit crimes? Earlier this month, officials in Australia announced plans to shoot and kill thousands of camels. What did the camels do to deserve this punishment? They were looking for water to drink, and the search brought them into human communities. Last year, U.S. federal and state governments spent tens of millions of dollars on plans to eradicate bands of feral pigs. What did the pigs do to deserve this punishment? They were looking for food to eat, and the search once again brought them into human communities. This year, Denver is poised to kill more of its Canada goose population. After slaughtering 1,600 geese last year, what are the geese doing to deserve this punishment? They're trying to live. Colorado is part of their historic range and are seen as a nuisance. These stories are the tip of the iceberg. While the details vary, the general theme is always the same. When human and non-human interests appear to conflict, we use violence, often in the form of organized extermination campaigns, to resolve these apparent conflicts in our favor. In many cases, we use militaristic, catastrophizing language to justify this violence. War on a natural enemy. Against other animals, other things, other natural forces. Instead of portraying non-humans as fellow creatures who are simply trying to exist, something to coexist with, we portray them as enemy invaders who are coming to destroy our communities. And again, this is in the context of talking about animals, but of course, as far as white supremacy is concerned, it's of course applied to other people as well. People from across a made-up, defined political border invading us, or disease, the virus. All the same rhetoric, all the same mindset. White supremacy manifest. For example, the New York Times, great lady, wrote last month regarding these feral pigs. Ranchers and government officials here are keeping watch on an enemy army gathering in the north along the border with Canada. They're oozing over us like maple syrup. The idea of invasive species is political as much as scientific. The U.S. federal government, for instance, defines invasive species as, quote, an alien species whose introduction does or is likely to cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health. By this definition, the mere potential to harm economic interest is enough to qualify a non-native species as invasive. Prominent ecologists like Mark Bickoff note that beliefs about the impacts of invasive species are value-laden as well, meaning biased by whatever values you have, like profit over people, what I know is better than what I don't know, what's familiar, and so on. Especially when these beliefs inform decisions about whether animals live or die, or if people are caged or free. When we use invasive species rhetoric, we might not intend for our language to contribute to violence against other animals, but it does. This rhetoric creates distance with other animals, erasing them as individuals who matter morally and erasing the reality that humans attack and kill non-humans much more than the reverse. This rhetoric makes it easier to rationalize killing other animals rather than searching for ways to peacefully coexist. Invasive species rhetoric is, of course, not the only way that humans create distance from other animals. We also create distance by calling individual animals it, by calling violence against certain animals a cull. This language is both a product of and a contributor to a deeper ideology that prioritizes human interests, and that means capital interests, by the way, above all else. An ideology that supports a policy of dispatching with perceived threats to human interests by any means necessary. According to this human-centric ideology, humans, or at least some humans, wink, wink, have the right to self-determination. Every other animal is assigned a role based on their value to our species. At one end of the spectrum, domesticated animals are meant to live in captivity and provide humans with benefits ranging from love to food. At the other end, and by the way, some people love their meat, so sometimes they're one and the same. At the other end, wild animals are meant to live in nature and provide humans with benefits ranging from beauty to ecosystem services. If wild animals play their role, we might let them be. But if they deviate from their human-prescribed role in the human-prescribed areas, we respond swiftly and brutally. Human activity is increasingly leaving other animals without a place to live. much like capital is leaving a lot of the poor without a place to live. Our species is taking more of the planet, and is also, through human-caused climate change, making more of the planet uninhabitable. It is no coincidence that pigs, camels, geese, and other invasive species are desperately searching for food, water, and shelter. While resource scarcity has always been a threat for non-humans, humans are making these threats worse and creating new ones. We then punish animals for trying to cope with the problems we create. Now, I'm adding in the kind of anti-capitalist, say, leftist rhetoric with that whole, like, it's capital interest, not just human interest, because vegans slash, you know, ecologists, media like this kind of put the focus on, like, man, the ultimate villain, the ultimate monster. I'm like, well, actually, as a species, you know, we are prone to over-hunting, over-killing, right? But I'm of the mindset that we can not do those things as a species by having a different set of economic values. As I said, the behavior is based on our values. It comes from our values. But what if, instead of assuming that non-humans are here for us, we accept that they deserve to live their own lives? We can learn to feel inspired rather than threatened by the surprising creative ways that other animals adapt. Pigs, for example, only exist in the Americas because humans brought them here. Yet, they have proven remarkably resilient. They can survive in many climates and are adapting to cold weather in Canada and the northern U.S. by learning to burrow into snow, creating so-called pigloos. Oh, that's such a cute word, pigloo. Similarly, what if, instead of scapegoating non-humans for resource scarcity, we accept that humans are, in fact, capital is primarily responsible? Well, let's accept their phrasing here. It's a human problem. Humans create capitalism, after all. Yet, Australian animal agriculture is much more responsible for this problem, along with other environmental ones. We also need to be thoughtful when assigning responsibility for violence against non-humans. Our focus should be on the societal structures. Again, it's like you could apply this to, you know, blaming black men for being shot by the cops, by police, and so on. Our focus should be on the societal structures that create these conflicts and the people in power who work to uphold them. In Australia, for instance, the people most responsible for the deaths of the camels are not Aboriginal communities who approve the cull. Instead, the people most responsible are the climate change denying political leaders who created the predicament. Many conflicts where it's like, you know, there's only enough water for the lawns of the Melbourne residents and not the camels. Many conflicts with other animals can disappear over time if we restructure society. And you probably might be thinking there are camels in Australia. Well, maybe there were probably brought over two. There's also kind of maybe subspecies of camel-like animals that I'm not actually familiar with. Finishing up. Many conflicts with other animals can disappear over time if we restructure, porn word, society to be more inclusive of other species. More territory and resources that we protect for other animals, for example, by creating parks and reserves, the less that these animals will need to enter our communities looking for food, water, or homes. And the more accommodations that we create for other animals in our communities, for instance, by making buildings and roads more animal-friendly, the less conflict there will be among humans and non-humans coexisting in these spaces. And by friendly, as an architect, I can also kind of say that it's also more animal-resilient. For example, a building on stilts is not ever going to get termite damage or be burrowed under and have its foundations shifted, let's say. Now, of course, I'm not saying all buildings need to be on stilts. I'm just saying that different building practices, less cheap practices, and more deliberate when the designing of foundations and the siding can make buildings less harmful to animals and thus make animals less harmful to buildings. As we work to build a more just society for humans and non-humans alike, what should we do about thirsty camels, hungry pigs, and other such animals? We might not, in this deeply imperfect world, be able to treat everyone in the manner they deserve, but we can and must envision better ways of living. If we can at least discuss perceived conflicts without describing animals as pests and invaders or treating violence as the default solution, then we might be surprised at how humane we can actually be. So moving on from talking about power relations and, you know, how talking about ecology can help us actually achieve and talk about and social justice, poverty, equality, and all the other social ills that we have, because environmental damage is, of course, one of them, and environmental justice and being linked with social justice overlapping is being well accepted in most activist and nonprofit communities. At least there's somewhat of a growing understanding. It's no longer fringe, as far as I can tell. But this is a story from The Guardian. Now to talk about, now I mentioned a theme of degrowth, or a concept that I'm going to always kind of return back to. But I think I'll introduce this by talking about briefly. I screwed up a bit, so I was planning to be on the ballot for state assembly as a Green Party candidate. Kind of on a whim. Not really going to be a serious campaign, but just be on ballot as a down ballot candidate for the presidential race. And also just to promote my agenda, which is that my political platform is two lines that broadly cover a lot of other types of thinking. So I don't have to list out 100 things or memorize 5 things, and I'll forget 2 of them. It's 2 things. Socialize the finance sector. Create public banks. Because unless money control, the financing of enterprises, is under public/social/community control, none of the other community benefits, community values type of things will be sustainable. It will always be working against the mindset of profits over people. Only by having a different finance sector out of the hands of Wall Street, or separate from Wall Street, but particularly replacing it, just as a public health care system where everyone actually gets it and it's all paid for with public pot, replaces private insurance, which is exploitative and doesn't actually provide health care for a majority of people. And even those who have insurance do not get it properly. And then part 2 of the platform is a 3-day work week. You know, all other environmental Green New Deal policy aside, I think one of those things that says, this is what makes me serious about reducing environmental damage. This is what greening the economy looks like for me. It means working less, producing less, consuming less. Probably not the best phrasing, because less isn't really popular. But it's also less work, less grueling hours, less commuting. Because the environmental benefits of the pandemic lockdown are completely arbitrary, because it was by chance that this, well, not chance, but it was by happenstance that it happened. B, it's temporary, right? The business sector is talking about anyone back to work. We want things to be back to normal, back to the normality of their profit making in our drudgery. In order not to be like, to go back to that, there's tons of policy to advocate for. More rent protections, tenant protections against rent seizing, and so on, and all that kind of stuff. But what really gets to the heart of degrowth is that we need to shorten the work week. This was a demand of the union movements during the original New Deal era. First, it was to shorten the work week itself, the creation of the weekend, to create a 5-day work week, to shrink it from 7 or 6, a 6-day work week to a 5-day work week. Now we need to do that again. So the compromise would be going to a 4-day work week. I advocate for 3. Because you look at the mass unemployment that we have currently, and that will increase, if not calcify, as our crisis continues. Then there is the automation that is then going to be pushed. The telework, the telecommuting, really it's not worth calling it telecommuting anymore, but the working from home, the automation of services and whatnot, the plans of calling human workers biohazards. This is something that the tech sector is starting to do as they make their new push for self-driving cars, trucks, and other types of automation that basically brings in more profits for them as they're selling the technology. Of course, they're promoting it. It's their product. Everyone's a salesman at the end of the day in a marketplace. Even if your product is harmful to society as a whole, the environment as a whole. And here's an example of that. Now I'll actually go to the story. To decarbonize, we must decomputerize. Why we need a Luddite revolution. This is by Ben Taroff. Big tech claims AI and digitization will bring a better future. But putting computers everywhere is bad for people and the planet. He goes on to explain. Our built environment is becoming one big computer. Smartness is coming to saturate our stores, workplaces, homes, cities. As we go about our daily lives, data is made, stored, analyzed, and used to make algorithmic, meaning math-based, inferences about us that are in turn structure our experiences. Computation encircles us as a layer, dense and interconnected. If our parents and our grandparents lived with computers, we live inside them. It's like our prison cell. But it gives us games and media and a lot of things to satiate us. A growing chorus of activists, journalists, and scholars are calling attention to the dangers of digital enclosure. Employers are using algorithmic tools to surveil, meaning watch, and control workers. Cops are using these tools to surveil and control communities of color. And there is no shortage of dystopian possibilities on the horizon. Landlords evicting tenants with smart locks. Health insurers charging higher premiums because your Fitbit says you don't exercise enough. Digitization doesn't just pose a risk to people, however. It also poses a risk to the planet. But last summer, referring to summer of 2019, was the hottest on record. Large chunks of the Arctic are melting. In India, more than 500 million face water shortages. Putting computation everywhere directly contributes to this crisis. Digitization is a climate disaster. If corporations and governments succeed in making vastly more of our world into data, there will be less of the world left for us to live in. Now, what is our elite leadership slash nonprofit slash billionaire sector proposing? Well, you can look at Gates himself, Bill Gates, much enthused, but he is, to me, a complete monster. Not because of his intentions, okay? Intentions don't make a villain. Villains are those that know the most and care the least. Bill Gates knows a lot. Smart guy, right? But he does not care about people very much. Being a billionaire kind of walls you off from the rest of human experience. A lot of his programs and policies are eugenicist in nature, you know, controlling populations, vaccinating against will, not actually engaging, like the trees. But instead of planting trees, he actually wants to, you know, provide the health care and all that. It's interesting the dynamic between the World Health Organization, which, by the way, is not a UN body, but is in fact a nonprofit foundation that, for the most part, Bill Gates controls. He's bought it. He pretty much funds 40% of it, which is the largest stake of anybody or anything else that donates money to it. So the World Health Organization is Bill Gates foundation, but he funds that and a bunch of other things because he cares about health and education so much, even though he really doesn't. He's not the expert here. But his answer is to track everybody, to track who has been vaccinated, when it's been produced eventually. That's what's interesting about the conflict between the Trumpites and the World Health Organization is that it's kind of a fight between this totalitarian in nature. Two totalitarian entities are basically duking it out for how we all our futures, you know. We're basically picking, and this is the thing about authoritarian dystopias, is that there's really kind of two types. There's the Mad Max society, or rather our civilization is broken down into a bunch of fiefdoms and strict violence-based hierarchies versus a totalitizing super state that controls everything and everybody. So there's, I guess, more people are alive. But there's a complete lack of freedom of movement and so on. And then the violence is structural and it's, you know, very efficient and orderly versus the disorderly violence of Mad Max and post-apocalypse. Take your pick, right? Now, of course, I'm doing the show because there is a third option, and it involves rejecting both of them. So please reject Bill Gates and the WHO and reject Trump. Both are bad saying that. Okay. It's okay to say both are bad. It's okay to be concerned about both the pandemic and our ability to shrink the damage from that and save lives, the ability to not succumb to a security state that's and the climate crisis. Okay, to understand, back to the article, to understand the relationship between data and climate, the best place to start is machine learning. Billions of dollars are being spent on researching, developing, and deploying ML, machine learning, because major breakthroughs in the past decade have made it a powerful tool for pattern recognition, whether analyzing faces or predicting consumer preferences. ML learns by training on large quantities of data. Computers are stupid. Babies knows what a face is within a few months of being alive. For a computer to know what a face is, it must learn by looking at millions of pictures of faces. This is a demanding process. It takes place inside the data centers we call the cloud. But much of the electricity that powers the cloud is generated by burning fossil fuels. As a result, ML has a large carbon footprint. In the recent paper that has made waves in this community, a team at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, found that training a model for natural language processing, the field that helps virtual assistants like Alexandria understand what you're saying, it can emit as much as 626,000 pounds of carbon dioxide. That's about the same amount produced by flying round trip between New York and Beijing 125 times. Training models isn't the only way ML contributes to the cooking of our planet. It has also stimulated a hunger for data that is probably the single biggest driver of digitizing everything. Corporations and governments now have an incentive to acquire as much data as possible, because that data, with the help of ML, might yield valuable patterns. So what makes the patterns valuable? It's mentioned that this is for selling things and other commercial applications. What makes it valuable is that it's valuable that it's for profit making, right? Now, the selling point in TED Talks and other such propaganda, I'm going to call it that, be less generous, is that this technology is also used for health planning and making our lives better. But we're not empowered by it at all. It's authoritarian in nature. Patterns like it might tell them who to fire, who to arrest, when to perform maintenance on a machine, and how to promote a new product. One of the best ways to make more data is to input small connected computers everywhere. Cisco predicts that there will be 28 billion network devices by 2022. Aside from the energy required to make and maintain those devices, the data they produce will live in a carbon-intensive cloud. Data centers currently consume 200 terawatt hours per year, roughly the same amount as all of South Africa. Anders Andria, a widely cited researcher in Huawei, tells me that number is likely to grow 5 times by 2030. This would put the cloud on par with Japan, the fourth biggest energy consumer on the planet. What can be done to curb the carbon costs of data? Greenpeace has long pushed cloud providers to switch to renewable energy sources, which, covered in previous episodes, aren't exactly clean either. These efforts have seen some success. The use of renewables by data centers has grown substantially. Oh, goody. Meanwhile, efficiency gains from better techniques and bigger economies of scale have moderated cloud's power consumption in recent years. When it comes to machine learning, a group of researchers are calling for a more energy-conscious approach, which they call green AI. These are encouraging trends, and tech workers themselves are likely to play a key role in advancing them. Amazon employees have been organizing for a climate plan since late last year, and they recently announced a global walkout for 20th of September. Among their demands is for the company to commit to zero emissions by 2030 and to stop selling cloud services to fossil fuel companies. But it's clear that confronting the climate crisis will require something more radical than just making data greener. That's why we should put another tactic on the table. making less data. We should reject the assumption that our built environment must become one big computer. We should erect barriers against the spread of smartness into all of the spaces of our lives. Remember, smart tech make for dumb people. The trick to decarbonize, we must decomputerize and to democratize. This proposal will no doubt be met with charges of Luddism. Good. Luddism is a label to embrace. Luddites, as a movement, were heroic figures and acute technological thinkers. They smashed textile machinery in the 19th century in England because they had the capacity to perceive technology, quoting them in the present tense. In the words of the historian David Noble, they didn't wait patiently for the glorious future promised by the gospel of progress. They saw what certain machines were doing to them in the present tense, endangering their livelihoods. So they dismantled them. We are often sold a similar bill of goods. Big tech companies talk incessantly about how AI and digitization will bring a better future. In the present tense, however, putting computers everywhere has been bad for most people. It enables advertisers, employers, and cops to exercise more control over us, in addition to helping heat the planet. Fortunately, there are latter-day Luddites working to stem this tide. Community groups like Stop LAPD Spying Coalition organizing the shutdown math-based algorithmic policing programs. A growing campaign to ban the government use of facial recognition software has won important victories in San Fran and Somerville, Massachusetts. Somerville is outside of Boston and basically adjacent to Cambridge and Harvard. While workers at Amazon are calling for the company to stop selling such software to law enforcement, and in the streets of Hong Kong, protesters are developing techniques for evading the algorithmic gaze, using lasers to confuse the cameras, and cutting down smart lampposts equipped with monitoring devices. Nothing beats the direct approach, folks. These are just a few possible sources of inspiration for a broader movement for decomputerization, one that pursues social and ecological goals simultaneously. And it should be mentioned that this does not mean giving up computers or computing or technology at all, just to, again, reduce, to fight against the complete totalitization of it, that it surrounds us and it's around, you know, controls us. We don't want that. We want to control the technology. That means computer and tech companies that are community-owned, publicly-owned, you know, socialist. I'm saying the loud part loud. For such a struggle to be successful, however, resistance is not enough. We also need a vision of the future we want. Again, the history of Luddites can be helpful. In 1812, that's how old that movement moment was, a group of Yorkshire Luddites sent a factory owner a letter promising continued action until the House of Commons passes an act to put down all machinery hurtful to the commonality. Following their example, we might derive a simple Luddite principle for democratizing technology. We should destroy machinery hurtful to the common good and build machinery helpful. What does this mean in practice? It's hard to think of anything more hurtful to our common life than heating large portions of the planet beyond a habitable level. Privacy advocates have long called for companies to restrict their collection of data to the minimum necessary to perform a service, a principle now enshrined in the GDPR, the EU's Omnibus Data Regulation. The 21st century Luddism should embrace this principle, but go no further. What matters is not only how much data a service collects, but what imprint that service leaves on us, and thus whether it should be performed at all. Decomputerization doesn't mean no computers. It means that not all spheres of life should be rendered into data and computed upon. Ubiquitous smartness largely serves to enrich and empower the few at the expense of the many, while inflicting ecological harm that will threaten the survival and the flourishing of billions. Precisely which computer activities should be preserved in a less computerized world is a matter for those billions themselves to decide. The question of whether a particular machine hurts or helps can only be answered by the commons itself. It can only be answered collectively through the experiment and argument of democracy. The zero carbon commonwealth of the future must empower people to decide not just how technologies are built and implemented, but whether they're built at all. Progress is an abstraction. It's just an idea that has done a lot of damage over the centuries. Luddism urges us to consider progress towards what and progress for whom. Sometimes a technology shouldn't exist. Sometimes the best thing to do with a machine is to break it. The last 2 minutes, I just want to draw a parallel. He mentioned that the, you know, computerization encloses us. That's an important word, because enclosure was what was done with land also many centuries ago in the creation of our economic system. Many sections of, there was a commons, you know, peasants, people, farmers, they had a commons. They all shared the land more or less. They divvied up plots, of course, but they all controlled it as a commons. There would be forests and hunting grounds and all that stuff. This is how Native Americans operated. This is how a lot of humanity operates. Till in the early 19th century, rather early 18th century, there was the Enclosure Acts, which enclosed land and thus made it private property in states that then people were kicked off of, and that's why they had to start working in factories. There was a bit of attraction there in ways, but it was also a matter of, we can't farm this land anymore without paying a certain rent. It's just more viable to then move to cities and then do factory work. It was economic planning by the early capitalists. A little history there. Now we're at the first end of the first hour, and now to the break. Left show, leftist reading hour. I'm your host, Dan Platt. That's with two A's. So I last let off, I was talking about degrowth. Decarbonizing the economy requires less computers, rather particularly less data collection, which is mostly used to control us.
I know, it's crazy.
But what does degrowth kind of look like in the policy sphere? I have a nice little Facebook post. So the post is ran for a random person, but it's a remarkable 170 Dutch academics put together a 5-point manifesto for economic change after the COVID-19 crisis, building on degrowth principles. It has gone viral in Dutch media, and here's a thread that summarizes the points in English. Principle one, shift from an economy focused on the aggregated GDP growth, meaning just the amount of interactions between money changing, create differences among sectors that can grow between those that grow and need investment, critical ones, and sectors that need to radically degrow, meaning advertising, mining, and fossil fuels. Principle two, build an economic framework focused on redistribution, which establishes a UBI, a universal social policy system, a strong progressive taxation of income, profits, and wealth, and reduced working hours and job sharing, meaning a 3-day work week, and recognize care work as well. Principle three is to transform farming towards a regenerative agriculture based on a biodiversity conservation. That means being sustainable, mostly local, and vegetarian, as well as fair agricultural employment. Number four is to reduce consumption and travel, with a drastic decrease in the wasteful consumption and travel to basic and, in transition to more satisfying consumption and travel. And number five is debt cancellation. That means for workers, for countries, and the global south, from all financial institutions. And this usually can't happen unless a big government order or, as I say, financial institutions need to be made public entities. So now that I've set out on the first hour kind of principles of degrowth and also kind of general attitudes towards nature, environmentalism, and the kind of that it's not worth doing unless it is empowering, democratic, and power structures are actually taken into account. Now let's go even deeper with a general analysis of what is called a hipster environmentalism or hipster capitalism. And it's a critique of a number of other things. In an earlier episode, my temporary co-host, Julian Dante, mentioned what Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything and how we can address climate change by focusing on the service economy. And there's another such proposals. But here from Uneven Earth, I really like this publication, though they're pretty long-winded, I do it on the show rarely. Why a hipster, vegan, green startup service economy lifestyle cannot be sustainable. So this is a general anti-capitalist mode here. So now I've kind of covered things in a more general way. Now I'm going to explain, why is this a capitalist problem, we're not thinking green enough, why can't... Again, it's not just a matter of switching the cloud to renewable energy. It's still an authoritarian, life-controlling, disempowering institution that takes away our agency. And so it's not good even if it is running on solar power. It's not enough to think in just terms of if it's fossil fuel or not. There's more to it. So service economies, industrial veganism, and hipsterized eco-aesthetics will only deepen the social and ecological damage wrought by capitalism. Now, all those three concepts, totally alien. Let's explain them in turn. This piece is a long-form version that originally appeared in Al Jazeera and can be found here. On the borderlands of Montreal's well-to-do Outremont district and the ultra-hipsterized Mile End district lies an expanse of land near the Canadian Pacific Railroad line. This space separates these two districts from Park Extension, one of Canada's poorest and most densely populated neighborhoods. Park X is a port of call for many newly arrived immigrants. This is a place where affordable housing is increasingly hard to come by and where eviction rates are on the rise. Walking along Avenue de Parc and its adjacent streets, one begins by passing vegan chain restaurants, hip vintage clothing joints, and coffee shops jostling for space among longtime Greek and Hasidic Jewish community establishments, before eventually arriving at Park X with its small immigrant-owned grocery stores, halal butcheries, and community centers of a very different kind of neighborhood. So this is also a strike against, a rhetorical strike against gentrification as well, that they are all part of the same system. Good to understand that. It is here, on the periphery of these stark socioeconomic separations, that the University of Montreal plans to construct its science campus, MIL, I'll just call it MIL, with an emphatic commitment to sustainable development. Sustainability for the new MIL campus means constructing a LEED certified building. That means it's to sustainability standards as they are currently outlined. Much maligned for not going far enough. But it includes currently energy efficient lighting, heat recycling, prioritizing electric vehicles and bikes, planting of trees, all part of broader efforts to achieve carbon neutrality. This ethos of eco-efficiency is also shared by the new campus neighbors. Tech firms, a Microsoft headquarters, AI research laboratories, fitting in with the last story, loosely affiliated with the university. Fusing technological innovation with eco-efficiency, the MIL campus epitomizes the spirit of, is the term, eco-modernism. Underlying the emerald green image of this new campus development is the assumption that capital and economic growth will naturally follow suit. This means revitalizing neighborhoods with student housing, condominiums, hip bars and microbrews, vegan nibbles, soy and almond milk latte bars designed for socioeconomically advantaged students, professors to enjoy. Green is gold within this logic, creating countless opportunities for advocates of Park X's revitalization to pursue profit without the guilt. But this modern green vision of growth, hipness, eco-conscious diets is far from regenerative. On the contrary, its success depends on creative destruction. This is what capitalism does best, of course, and in such destruction is anything but green. In what follows, we aim to highlight the dangers of the political economic system that continues profit under the veil of a greener, more efficient capitalism, all while reinforcing inequality and still harming the environment. In this way, projects like this urban renewal are the continuation of Canada's deeply, and thus also America's, deeply colonial tradition of disempowering the First Nation people and their ways of life and their networks, however green the market may be. So first, let's cover the myth of green growth, meaning shifting to the service economy. The MIL campus at Park X is just one piece of a global story behind capitalism's greening. To understand how they connect, we need to retrace our steps back to 92. Again, the backdrop of the Soviet Union's recent fall, the UN Earth Summit that year opened up the new global frontier for unrestrained capital. Under the auspices of the term sustainable development introduced at that summit, capitalism was able to tap into a panoply, that's a $5 word, of social and green values and use them for its own ends. In the years that followed, governments, businesses, techno-optimists teamed up with would-be environmentalists to envision a greener world that nonetheless kept efficiency at the core of its growth-oriented mandate. Gotta grow or die. Environmentalism became neutralized as a concern for the elite. That includes policy experts, economists, Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, for whom new markets and techno fixes would repeatedly affirm the exceptionalism of modern humanity. Soon enough, environmentalism was all but depoliticized for the purposes of expanding profit under a green economy. And thus, unless you are directly or explicitly opposing the system as a whole, being anti-capitalist, this is, to me, my conclusion, you're going to be absorbed into it. Now, this is my argument about party politics, too. Unless you're directly opposing the Democratic Party, you're going to be sucked in to the games that the leadership play. This depolitization, meaning, you know, it's not political anymore, stop making things political, guys, of environmentalism itself is what drives today's unquestioning acceptance of ideas of this green growth through more efficient lifestyles, tech, and service-based economies. Even though at the end of the day, we still need to make stuff. We still consume stuff. But then it becomes a matter of who's making it. It's people abroad. we've shifted the burden of producing all the goods to someone else. So now, what would be our carbon emissions becomes China's carbon emissions. For those unfamiliar with the technical details of the debate, green growth is predicated on decoupling. Now, I've covered this concept in previous episodes. Look in the archive under anything with greenwashing in the title. So this episode could be greenwashing part four. Under capitalism and its relentless pursuit of growth, environmental considerations are inevitably reduced to a question of efficiency. And that means the profit-making efficiency, while still expanding productive and consumptive inputs. In turn, people concerned with minimizing their footprints are led to believe that they only have one course of action, improving their own individual efficiency in their everyday life. For example, by eating less meat, driving electric vehicles, biking to work. These are all choices that are constructive, but focusing our efforts for systemic change through atomized personal choices undermines that transition. Indeed, what green capitalism doesn't want you to realize is that collective action is more than a collection of individual ones. But here's an important question. Is the service economy really any cleaner? The creative class and the knowledge economy are sustained by a material base of agriculture, housing, construction, manufacturing, and all the other sectors that are still not clean. Depoliticized environmentalism is rife with the fabulously hipsterized startup enclaves emerging in cities around the world, especially in the global north. Far from the achieving green efficiency, the jobs that fuel these high-tech startups, together with other professions of the creative class, and that means artists, musicians, academics, architects, all rely on a high degree of resource demands whose impacts span the world over. Those who argue that growth can be accompanied by a dematerializing economy typically hold the assumption that these knowledge and creative classes somehow have a lower impact than those engaged in farming or manufacturing, these so-called dirty jobs. But is the service economy really a cleaner and greener? Creative class and the knowledge economy are sustained by all these other sectors. The technology that enables the knowledge economy is also far from immaterial. At the current rate of growth, internet-connected devices will consume 1/5 of global electricity demand. So that's a different stat for the same concept I was covering before the break. Solid waste streams. In spite of the evidence that the service economy is little more than an alluring myth, why do so many remain enthusiastic about eco-modernist visions of innovative green cities? Well, not only do our service economies fundamentally depend on all the, you know, making stuff, but typically those that exist on the other side of the planet. The further away that the almond milk production is from central London coffee shop, the less guilty we feel, out of sight, out of mind. But this is not only the case with the resource use, but also the waste. Exports of e-waste currently represent the fastest growing solid waste stream. Gregorios Kallas argues, energy use in the U.S. is not increasing, not because a peak has been reached due to technological efficiency or service economies, but because the U.S. economy imports its garments from China and it has its servers in Norway. Thus, while the service economy may appear to be lighter than manufacturing and farming, its reliance on these other sectors for its own existence invalidates the claims that we can decouple services from environmental impact. We also see that any actual efficiency improvements in the service economy are quickly swallowed up by the shifting costs of the demand. A demand for other countries where labor and resources are cheaper. We need to get out of the habit of looking at only a small part of the whole system, often while remaining captivated by notions of natural borders, for which we clearly know that neither resources, energy, or capital flows abide by. Once again, Kallas reminds us that we should not confuse declines in impact, environmental impact, due to units of production, but also as Low Tech Magazine, I love this guy, informs us, global resource and energy use keeps increasing annually, growing an average 3% a year, more than double the rate of population growth. It is therefore crucial to recognize that being so far removed from production and consumption around the world does not exonerate our service economies. Much like the green service economy, the purported eco-efficiency of veganism also deserves our scrutiny. Now, this is, say, nothing of the moral arguments for veganism. We can cover those, and I agree with them for the most part. But this is just directed at the veganism is more environmental. In some ways, it very much is. But there's when it, within capitalism, something else is going on. Let's explore. Let's look into that. The rise of veganism in the last decade has been mind-boggling. From what began as a subversive and anti-establishment form of defying the global food industry, as most things usually start, with its horrific treatment of non-human animals, veganism has transformed into a cash cow. Mainstreaming veganism is ostensibly a win-win-win situation, or so we'd like to believe. Once, say, any countercultural thing is mainstreamed. Let's say socialism is mainstreamed, right? The support for unions. There's kind of a inkling that, you know, I have, and from historical viewing, that once something is mainstreamed, it basically becomes absorbed by capitalism. Once unions got popular enough, 40% of the workforce, union management became nothing more but large managers. They just became another set of management, and thus, over time, just as unpopular as the bosses. Could veganism become the same thing? Well, if history's any judge, I think it would be, as long as it's within the logic of capital. Mainstream, okay, veganism, like innovations to urban eco-efficiency, is itself a positive thing. But when we consider veganism from the perspective of a rebound effect, things become a little more complicated. Oxford researcher Dr. Marco Springman explored the potential benefits of the world going vegan. In a scenario where a tax on the consumption of animal products leads to them being phased out entirely by 2050, this is a hypothetical. But what would happen to the economy? Springman projected that economic benefits for the global economy would amount to $1.5 trillion, comprised of savings in healthcare costs, you know, less heart disease, in cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 2/3, and savings won by avoiding the disastrous effects of a global climate crisis. But what happens to that $1.5 trillion? Under capitalism, such a surplus in savings would never simply be left idle, but reinvested into further growth elsewhere. Here, the rebound effect rears its head once again. If we understand growth from the perspective of thermodynamics, so let's put some physics in there, we see that it will always require resource inputs and always produce waste. Regardless of how more efficient our food eating can be, if we stop consuming animal products, meat, dairy, the reinvestment of overall cost into more growth of one sort or another will ultimately drive more resource input, in turn leading to more waste. In other words, increases in scale eventually negate and then outpace the efficiency improvements. You can see this again and again in any kind of sort of the economy, including energy. Replace fossil fuels with renewables, and the demand for this cleaner electricity will triple. And then you'll need triple the amount of solar panels, which requires triple the amount of mining of lithium, or the mining of the seabed for battery minerals, things I've covered previously. It's actually bigger, badder. And before you know it, it's soil and green world. The same logic applies to organic agriculture. If overall health and environmental cost efficiencies are internalized into economic growth forecasts, the surplus is most likely to be invested into further growth. Unless targeted efforts are made by national governments to deflect the savings, to pay down national debt, or redistribute that savings, the marginalized, let's say homes for the homeless, full social housing, stuff like that. However, within a global capitalist economy, this would put the country at a competitive disadvantage. As long as we're competing globally, we can't actually do what's best for the common good. Something it would likely attempt to compensate for at the expense of marginalized people. Growth for the sake of growth is a zero-sum game. It negates every effort we could collectively make to satisfy more with less stuff. As Justin Hickel writes, we might shift the economy to services such as education and yoga, but even universities and workout studios require stuff. Unfortunately, the degree of stuff and energy reductions needed to respond to the climate crisis means that while veganism is important, it is simply not enough if it remains an avenue to continually expand profit. A world of industrial vegan farming would be devastating both to the world's biodiversity and its reliance on monocultural fruit and veggie crops, but also in its failure to provide a dignified existence for its workers and its detrimental effects on the basic support system. So sure, we could all switch to almond milk, as I have, individually, but I know that the almonds are being grown with migrant labor. And that's bad. And I want that to change. And that means it's not enough to just switch to almond milk and go vegan. And buy the stuff made by Kellogg and the big five food companies, which now all have their own brand of meat alternatives. Some are better than others. In this case, then why does industrial veganism retain its alluring appeal? Again, growth-oriented capitalism will tempt you by selling veganism as something that aligns with your values, your health, and your conscience, and your lifestyle. But as Cowspiracy co-director Kip Adamson suggests, people feel empowered. It doesn't feel like a sacrifice. That's a huge shift. Whereas before, veganism may have been viewed like you were giving up something, now it's been reframed as what you gain. You gain health. You gain a greater sense of living in bounds within your values. You gain all the environmental benefits. It is also worth noting that the failure to repoliticize veganism will not only lead to further ecological damage, but also perpetuate cultural symbolic violence, which has material effects. How? Though we might think of veganism as social, culturally, and politically neutral, like any other consumer choice, which is a mistake, this is far from the case. On the contrary, veganism has a tendency to play into hegemonic logic of who is more pure and who isn't. For one of the authors of this essay, being raised vegetarian in the upper caste Hindu family reveals how the moral policing of eating habits can be weaponized to condone unthinkable violence. Under a current right-wing Hindu fundamentalist government in India, street lynchings and brutal killings are being justified by narratives of India as a nation only for cow-loving Hindus. Vijay's lived experience shows that the decision to go meatless is not neutral, but entangled in complex reality. As such, Western capitalism's romanticization of elements of Eastern culture to promote veganism is ultimately misguided. We have already witnessed the damaging effects of such colonial logic in the past. The reproduction by vegan saviors from the global north is the last thing we need. To sum it up, industrial veganism revolves around personal choice, personal gain, and convenience. This reinforces the very same apolitical, go your own way, I got mine, individualism that atomizes us, erodes our drive to engage politically with our world in this way, and disempowers us. Ethical consumption and the death of the politicized citizen emerge together. The belief that you can change the world, but you can change yourself, is precisely what allowed neoliberalism to run rampant with corporate parasites. It allowed corporate capitalism to parasite the state to expend at the expense of our interests. Today, to repoliticize veganism is paramount importance, ensuring that we don't lose sight of the social, ecological, and animal rights agendas at the heart of that movement. And this goes for any other movement, goes for any other cause. If it's not political, you're just buying stuff, buying ketchup. And that is not freedom. So here, the third aspect of hipster gentrification, not only its social harms, but also linking that to how unsustainable it is, both as an economy and it's unsustainable as far as like social goods, is the power inequality and the production of Kool. And think Kool is something that can be made in a marketplace, but, well, you might have a sense of that. Just as the cultural dimension of veganism reveals deeply problematic tendencies, there is something deeper, more pernicious, and fundamentally cultural at the core attempts to pair eco-efficiency with economic growth. Projects like the Mill Campus, going back to that, and the rehab of Park X, the immigrant neighborhood, exclude working class and racialized communities through aesthetic preference. It is no coincidence that hipsterized coolness comes with a hefty price tag. Vintage furniture, organic markets, tattoos, third wave coffee shops all seem relatively benign, but ultimately serve to reinforce class division. As academics living in a hip area of a hip city like Montreal or New York or Brooklyn, we constantly struggle with the ways in which our aesthetic preference actively shape themselves or shaped by a particular class. Our efforts to acknowledge our complicity here and thus act responsibly in the face of these classist mechanisms have forced us to pay closer attention to the impacts they have, to these symbols. On the one hand, coolness just is. It is imbued with all the things that reflect a deeper relational value of care, affection, creativity, connection, and authenticity, meaning it should have no racial, gendered, or other boundaries, and likewise have no impact on those fronts either. On the other hand, it is also the reproduction of a particular way of being, which inevitably and invariably sets in motion these new ways for capital to expand. Cool is just another way of marketing something. Allowing for everything, you know, just like rainbow Oreos. There's a good example of that. It became cool to be pro-gay rights or pro-gay marriage, particularly. And thus, corporations started putting rainbows everywhere. Soon it will be trans flags, but trans rights will still not complete. Just as George Mandelbrot reminds us that celebrity culture is the smiling face of the corporate machine, coolness making is not culturally benign either. It's not apolitical. It is a political act to watch the Jenners and whatnot. Let's see. It goes hand in hand with historically entrenched asymmetries of power between those who are the forerunners of style and those whose foreignness has seen them systematically excluded. This power imbalance with all those racialized and gender dimensions are most obvious in the ways in which capital, i.e. profit-making, tends to most align with it. Progressives who wish to do good but also promote a cultivated cool aesthetic must reflect more seriously on how coolness is made and its deeper political consequence. It creates an inequality. Who's cool and who's not. To be cool is to be popular. What's popular is what's marketed. What's marketed is what is making money. If you're not cool, how can you earn a living? How can you be the right person to be hired by the third wave coffee shop? That's a kind of strike against, you know, gentrification. It's bringing jobs to these poor neighborhoods. You know, by this is economic development. But who's being hired in those coffee shops? Is it the person who's being priced out of their apartment upstairs? No, they're not the right type of cool. May not be considered cool in any way. They're not the right person. They're not culturally relevant. Eco-efficiency does not emerge in a vacuum. You know, and it comes through in something that kind of annoys me on a picture-sharing page of my hometown of Albany. There was a mural in the distance of one of the pictures, and someone commented, "Oh, sad that there's graffiti over there." And I'm like, even if they were tags, and this is the side of a parking garage, even if they were tags, that would still be preferable to nothing, in my opinion. Because I don't judge what's cool or not based on some, well, profit-making ideas of what's good or not, what's good art. Whether it's a mural, birds, or tags, to me, expression and art is art. It doesn't matter if it's funded by the state or not. It's improvement on nothing, on a blank parking garage. But the assumption that it was graffiti, even though they could really not make it out, and they had to be corrected, was I'm going to say it. That's racism, baby. At the very least, it's classism to say that graffiti is low class and the mural is high class. Desirable. Raises property values. Graffiti is low class. Lowers property values. Undesirable. Uncool. Not part of economic development. Eco-efficiency does not emerge in a vacuum. The city is an organism. It has tendrils that stretch across every geography, every country. This interdependence is an inconvenient detail overlooked by the urban progressive hipster. And I would say any kind of progressive who is not radical. Because, you know, a progressive, as the name suggests, puts progress first. But as mentioned in the, you know, computerizing, you know, progress is part of the problem, that progress at any cost, and progress for who? For one set of people and not another. It's assumed that progress is for everybody, but that there's blind spots there. It's missing the big picture, that there's all this other harm, that the progress of tech in America is dependent on exporting the waste of that progress that's created to China or to India. While privileged urban populations bind to aesthetics of sustainable, cool capitalism is literally burning up our planet and burning through its resources, an aloof, detached, apolitical coolness driven by individualism and aesthetics cannot be the basis on which we fight for anything, including our future. While lifestyles appear marginally efficient, they are by and large a fabulous experiment of shifting social and ecological costs to those less privileged, both logically and globally. So how can we move forward from here? But here's the ultimate message here of this piece. Now is the time to abandon a singular focus on lifestyle choice and to instead see resistance to externally conceived and profit-driven development as a moral and survivalist imperative. We must work to reestablish community for solidarity economies, replenish those relations served by growth-centered logic. This can start by simply getting to know your neighbors, generally being reflective and aware of the ways in which everyday actions impact those who live in different places and circumstances. Say the people you might be tempted to complain about if they are neighbors. By rejecting individualistic green lifestyles, we also reject their underpinning myths about decoupling and energy. Any gains in technological efficiency must be accompanied by an economy built not on growth, profit and self-interest, but care and responsibility. So many mentioned around me, speaking myself, about responsibility, radical responsibility, whatever. And they think that people can be responsible when we're not all trying to be salesmen. If they are to be effective, period. This not hipsterized eco-efficiency is where we should channel our desires for sustainability, something that so many of us are so dearly committed to, and something that we all urgently need. Now, this long-form piece is pretty much my justification for why I'm not actively for this kind of this eco-modernism. When development occurs in my city, I can oppose it on the grounds that it's gentrification. It's pushing the poor out. That's the obvious layer. The second layer is I oppose it because it's not actually sustainable. Putting a green roof on a building that still has massive, like it's still has an active energy-consuming heating and cooling system is still not good. It's not good enough. And that the real estate market that this building is going up in is exploitative. It's based on profit-seeking, rent-seeking, not producing goods and services, just extracting value. Value to pay back the finance sector. And that's why taking that out, to me, is step one. It's the ultimate step. And then the question is, what would it take to take out the finance sector, to create a new one, to have a bit better one, to reform it? That's the big question. Say Vijay is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Quebec. His research interests pivot around a decolonial future, political ecology, degrowth, and environmental policy. He's based in Montreal. The other writer is a Daniel Horgan Greenford, PhD student in geography planning at Concordia University and the economics for the Anthropocene That means like human-centered era. At McGill, that's the big university in Montreal as well. He is active in policymaking and politicking in the climate movement. You can find him occasionally in Twitter. Warren Greenford. Okay. Oh, yeah. The overarching joke of the skit show Portlandia is kind of like this lifestyleism in a nutshell. Like every joke in that show, not every joke, of course, but most of the jokes, most of the premises of the skits was just how none of this cool economy, service economy focused Portland makes any sense, that you can make fun of it because of these all the contradictions it has, that it talks of being sustainable while it's adjacent to poverty, or that it's a more conscious and more ethical. Meanwhile, poverty abounds. It's dependent on migrant labor. That it's usually unseen. Let's see, there's another point that's coming to me now about the blind spots, the kind of the things that are ignored. Oh, yeah. That in science fiction, that said that there's two types of science fiction. There's the kind that's really technical, that is much more, that's the non-fictional part of science fiction, the science part, where it really does seek to explain or project, explore how certain technology or society works. That's the kind I kind of like. The other kind doesn't really care about how things work, and it's called FM, expletive magic, freaking magic. And it's called freaking magic because it really doesn't care about how anything works. How is everything computerized? How does the voice recognize what you're saying? Currently, we all, rather the popular culture, treats all of our systems as freaking magic. They just are. It doesn't matter how it came into being, how it works, what it depends on, energy-wise, human labor-wise. What's the pollution abroad? What's the pollution here at home? All ignored, all not to worry about, and non-political. In fact, anything that's power-related is treated as freaking magic. You know, how does our government function? How does Trump have so much power? It's all magic. All just seem to be conjured into being by our own beliefs that these people have power. Mainstream media is going to cover it like it's the most important thing. Because there are wide-ranging effects. How will a vaccine be developed? You know, how is a building tubes underground? All of Elon Musk's projects. How will there ever be enough lithium to build and replace our fleet of cars with electric vehicles? It's magic. Or just to be honest about those questions is to expose the contradictions that none of it makes sense. And it's all right to be confused by how things work, because it doesn't. Doesn't work socially. Doesn't work with any sense of values of fairness, sustainability, whatever, freedom. How are you doing? You're on now.
Okay.
So for the last hour, I've had Paul Smart, program director, with me. Now that I've kind of run out of gas, are you comfortable taking the last 10 minutes?
I guess I can. I've been doing, in addition to doing the news each morning, which now replays during drive time in the evening, which is as much as it's been a kind of a recounting of what the news are. And my big worry of late is that everything we're reading these days, it's like a mono news source. There's only one subject with an asterisk, and that subject is, it's either coronavirus or it's Trump.
It's saying one or the dumb other.
Yeah,
it's the stuff same about the virus,
right? And you just get different variations of it, and it's very hard to maintain focus on what really drives our lives, which are not necessarily the things in front of us at all times. You know, there's other aspects of things. I mean, right now we've got...
Well, the news doesn't even seem to address the direct things.
Right. Well, part of it is that, I mean, I worked for 30-some years for a publication down in the Hudson Valley, Woodstock Times, and my specialty there was covering land use issues and, you know, these things that aren't sexy but really determine how a community shapes itself or gets shaped from the outside. You know, one of the bigger stories in recent years was, I remember about 5 years ago saying, hey, you know, we should do something about Airbnb. And I remember my editors and publishers saying, what's Airbnb? And, mm-hmm. you know, at that point, I did a little research. I said, look, they are controlling, at that point, there are 650 Airbnb rentals in the town of Woodstock, which had 2,000 structures.
Because so many people want to visit Woodstock.
And it's become a whole way of people making money. And you know, so we started to cover that. You know, they passed a law about how to deal with short-term rentals. The law was included that everybody had to go in front of the planning board and the zoning board of appeals, kind of pro forma, which meant that suddenly, you know,
to approve an Airbnb rental.
Yeah. And okay. So in the fall and January, February, you know, I went to a number of these meetings just to see how they operated with 15 to 30 public hearings set for every, and they were just pro forma, bing, bang, out, in and out again. But now you have a situation where all meetings came to a close. You know, there's just no meetings of any sort on planning issues, on, you know, school boards are just starting to meet again.
Is that because, you're just talking about the pandemic, not
the
that
pandemic,
it's all been automated?
Affects it all. No. But a lot of those decisions still have to be met. So it takes a lot of, the result of all of this was, A, the paper that I wrote for the Woodstock Times came to a close after 48 years. They stopped publishing. Since then, they've tried to move everything online, and you know, so they've asked me.
Green Pages has been trying to do that for 2 years now.
It's very hard. It's very hard to get people, you know, to turn online because they're competing with, you know, when you're looking at the news on your phone, you're constantly getting blips from the national news. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, Trump burped or Trump.
Yeah, he burped. Yeah. Yeah. Ubiquitous distractions.
You know, so yes. Anyway, what's happened at Woodstock Times during the interim, I found ways of just calling up people around basic issues like, okay, this past week I did a story. What happened to all the timelines for all these planning issues? So there are state timelines and federal timelines on how long something can be in the planning process. And, I'm doing something next week on just what happened to trout fishing season, you know, where you have to have permits and other things.
It brings to mind a concept that, like, if you're not covering an issue as it's coming up, then you've kind of missed it. Like, a lot of mainstream news gathering, usually it's like we'll go to pay attention to something once it's big enough
or once it's happened.
Right.
Once it's happened.
But then once it's happened, it's already old news. It's already obsolete
right.
information.
So, yeah, if you,
no
if,
one you're reacting to something that's already happened, something that's already, let's say if it's a business or a model of doing things, it's already too big, it's established,
and it's
no one can react
shifts,
to it in any
it shifts
meaningful
the
way.
Nature of the coverage too. I get, you know, the Guardian and the New York Times and a number of these, you know, Washington Post feeds, and you look at the headlines and most of them are, they have a moralistic tone. It's this happened or why did this happen? Why mm-hmm. did this happen? Which is all, you know, when you ask a question in
the
your
five
headline,
questions.
Yeah. So anyway, what I've ended up doing, which is now starting to kind of segue into what we do here at Community Radio is they gave me a daily blog in which I just observe what's going on around and make little stories. Like the other day I saw it was like a bird embryo on the street, and you know, things, and just I kind of extrapolated on that. Or yesterday I've been doing a lot of walks in cemeteries, which seem, you know,
very popular pastime now.
I know, but it's, you know, they're and reading a lot, and it's sort of this realization that, you know, a lot of the news that really matters to us in communities, you know, that can actually help us through this time, these challenges of health and politics and economics, is by paying more attention to what's exactly around us, as well as what's in our heads. But I wanted to end with one quote, which I just picked up while you were reading, which is, we go to fiction, and this is for somebody who commenting on the number of people who are turning back to classic novels these days. We go to fiction to discover how fictional people in literature may have reacted to the same sort of experiences we have, such as loss and death and love. And it just, it's a way of kind of just pointing out that our culture still matters in times like this.
Of course. Outro. First, my profound thanks for listening. An important skill is important as talking. So I plan to listen to any constructive feedback sent in, ideas for the show, stories, or topics you'd like to hear discussed. Capitalists and statists alike don't believe work like mine is worth paying a living wage, but you can by supporting the show via its Patreon page, Three Left Show. Support with your time by telling others you believe would be interested about the show, liking and sharing our Facebook and Twitter posts and pages, all found by searching Three Left Show on those platforms. The last 10 episodes are broadcast on all or most podcasting apps, and a full archive of show notes and info about myself and are found at threelefts.news. Of course, the most important thing is to put the ideas, thinking, and projects talked about here in practice for yourself. Thanks. Until next time, keep waving the flags of the Three Lefts.